Chapter 34, Let's Talk Turkey by Willie Snow Etheridge. 34, Farewell to Turkey. After only 4 days in his Kinderon, the captain said he figured we would be unloaded by noon, but we would wait for the 2:35 train from Istanbul to see if the air compressor, which we had left behind to be repaired, was on it. The train trip takes 2 days and two nights from Istanbul, for the distance is practically the same as from New York to Miami. To cheer our departure, Boutros Bey and Mr. Vasiliades invited the captain, the second mate, the Turkish woman, the roommate, and me to lunch at the casino. This was a pavilion built over the sea with only a roof of interlaced dead tree branches to keep off the sun and rain, if any. We began the meal, as usual, with stacks of tomatoes and cucumbers, and next we had whole eggplant stuffed with minced lamb and great mounds of rice, shiny and tasty in olive oil. But what to have for the main course? That was the question. A platter of freshly caught fish, raw, of course, and it seemed to me still breathing, was passed about for our inspection, and some settled for these. But the second mate and I went into the kitchen to look over the complete array on the big wood stove. There were lamb stew rich with oil, sweet little onions and tomatoes rich with oil, mutton rich with oil, eggplant and tomatoes rich with oil, and baked chicken ready to be spread upon mounds of rice. Yes, rich with oil. I liked everything, but thinking bitterly and a bit tardily about my figure, I took fish after all and just a small saucer of eggplant and tomatoes. Even so, when the roommate saw my plate, he announced, "When I get you home, I'm going to sell you for a tub of lard." Cowed, I starved through the rest of the meal with just a bunch of black grapes, a bunch of white grapes, two peaches, and a measly little cup of Turkish coffee. After 2 hours of eating, we said farewells and scattered to our various appointments. Boutros Bey and Mr. Vasiliades were going to pick up all necessary customs officials so as to get the air compressor, which they spoke of as the armature, off the train, that is, if it arrived. "We have arranged everything," boasted Mr. Vasiliades. "We have the three top customs officials coming with us to hasten the armature immediately from the train and transfer it to the ship. Ordinarily, it would take at the very earliest until tomorrow evening to get such a package out of the express." "It will no doubt still take until tomorrow evening," the roommate and I said simultaneously under our breaths. "Nevertheless, we would act as if these were our last few hours in Turkey and spend all the lire we had left." The roommate hired the finest carriage he could find. It twinkled from bow to stern with gleaming brass and had a magnificent pair of carriage lamps with graceful brass birds perched upon their tops. Instantly, I coveted them to put on my stoop at home. "She wants your carriage lamps," the roommate yelled to the driver, who understood a little English. "How much carriage lamps?" Over his shoulder, he flashed us a gold-tooth smile. 6,000 lira. My stars, $2,000. He must have thought I wanted a carriage and a pair of horses, too. "Forget them," said the roommate in the brusque way men have. "He has told you politely that they are not for sale." So I forgot them, and with the red plush-lined carriage top shoveled back and the bell of the driver's seat pealing out continuously in full, clear, sweet notes, we clomped through the narrow streets, thronged with pantalooned men and women, looking for a shop with Turkish handiwork. Baskets for bread were my idea, but I had to be satisfied with small suitcase types of bread, woven in shades of blue and green. Baskets for bread were my idea, but I had to be satisfied with small suitcase types of baskets woven in shades of blue and green. "What next?" asked the roommate. "How much money have we left?" "About 15 lira. "Oh, good. I'll buy a gold charm for Peg's bracelet. Peg is the wife of our oldest son, Bubber, and is mad about charms." After many peals of the bell and snappings of the whip above the horse's back, we came to a hole-in-the-wall jewelry shop and bought a charm scrawled with the signature of Suleiman the Magnificent. "Any more money?" "Just a few lira. But remember, I have to pay for the carriage, and besides, we have to get back to the ship. If it is sailing at 3:30, as the captain says, we have no more time for shopping. It is not going to sail at 3:30. Maybe not, but we can. But can't we take a chance? But we can't take a chance unless you want to be left in Turkey. That ended that argument. We reared back in the carriage, the wind fanning our hot faces, and headed for the ship. It was a long drive along the shore with pines and acacias shading the way. "You like this?" asked the roommate in one of his rare amiable moods. "I love it. You admit marrying me was a lucky..." He never finished the sentence. In the middle of the sentence, we saw Mr. Big, and so did I. He saw Mr. Big, and so did I. Nobody could possibly miss him. He was standing on the top of a bright red oil drum on a truck of drums rattling rapidly toward the town. "Mr. Big," I screamed as he streaked by, "you'll miss the ship." "Nah, I won't," he shouted back and then was gone. "God damn," stormed the roommate. "You can always count on your children to do some goddamn fool thing. He's your child, too, remember? Not when he acts like that." "Really? Really?" he mimicked me. "I was never irresponsible like that. God damn, what a brainless jackass. What are you going to do when he misses his ship?" "He hasn't missed it yet." "He will. You can always count on your children missing anything that is to be missed." Our arrival at the gangplank put a temporary end to his fumings, but when we learned the Moline was actually unloaded and that the longshoremen were covering the hatches at this moment, he started again. "What possessed that little fool to leave the ship just as she was ready to sail?" he fussed, leaning on the bulkhead of the second deck, watching the wharf cranes swing the hatches into their slots. "He went on an errand for some of the crew," the first engineer volunteered, also leaning on the bulkhead. "Last night, he and Sammy, the Negro dining room steward, found some goatskin drums in a shop in town and brought two back to the ship. Now four of the crew want goatskin drums. They took up a collection and sent Junior to town to buy them." Stars! I had seen Mr. Big's goatskin drum, and if I had known of the demand for drums, I would have been delighted to swap it for a bar of soap. It was about the size of an umbrella stand and made of cheap earthenware with a piece of goatskin stretched across the bowl end. I shuddered to think of the roommate's reactions when he had to get off the ship in New York and onto the train in Louisville. The last section of the last hatch was being banged into place when we saw a horse and carriage coming down the long pier towards the ship. "Do you suppose Mr. Big is in that?" I asked the roommate. "Hell no, he hasn't enough sense to get a carriage." But when the carriage stopped near the foot of the gangplank, out from behind the driver appeared Mr. Big, or rather four Turkish drums with Mr. Big's legs and feet sticking out beneath them. "Poor lamb," I mourned. "He's as loaded down as a hamal." Then turning to the roommate, I begged, "Darling, don't you want to go help him? He'll never get up the gangplank with those monstrosities. "Hell no, I didn't tell him to go buy them, did I?" Somehow Mr. Big made it alone and with face flushed and smiling, as if he had done nothing to send us prematurely to our graves, he joined us on deck. It seemed as though he had arrived none too soon. The hatches were closed, the oilcloth coverings drawn across them, and the last longshoreman had gone ashore. But the compressor was still to come. We waited expectantly, leaning more and more heavily on the forward bulkhead. In addition to the first engineer, we were joined by the second engineer, the first electrician, and the radio operator. We were all as motionless as birds on a telephone wire. "If the train was on time, the air compressor ought to be here," fretted the first engineer. "It is now after 4:30. "This seems like a repeat performance of Izmit," I commented. "Does anyone really know whether the air compressor is on the train?" "Well, we know it left Istanbul on the train," the first engineer answered. "The agent there telephoned the old man it was on, but whether it's still on, God knows." We continued to wait now in heavy silence. The heat was bad, and we were weary from our exertions and anxieties. Finally, an automobile sped down the pier and stopped beneath our bow. Boutros Bey and Mr. Vasiliades hopped out. "The armature approaches," shouted Mr. Vasiliades, waving a handkerchief. "It comes, it comes." Before we knew it, so busy were we looking for the approaching armature, Boutros Bey and Mr. Vasiliades joined us on the second deck. "We are sweating," Mr. Vasiliades announced, pulling his cream-colored silk shirt away from his plump body. "It has been a day." We couldn't agree more. "But now the armature comes," he rejoiced. "It comes in a hay burner." "A hay burner?" I questioned, my mind duller than usual. "Is that what we in Iskenderun call a horse and buggy?" He chuckled delightedly, showing his silver, gold, and white teeth. "The horse burns hay, you know." Mr. Vasiliades was the first to spot the hay burner. "There she comes," he yelled elatedly. "There comes the armature with the customs broker sitting on the box." The customs broker alighted from the box, and the driver's box, that is, and not, as I first thought, the box containing the armature. And several dock workers sprang to lift the box containing the armature from the floor of the carriage. "Nobody from ship will go down to help with this?" cried Mr. Vasiliades, both his arms flying into the air. "There are 100 Arabs already there," answered the first engineer, considerably exaggerating the number. But after all, he had been under a nervous strain. "But doesn't someone in authority want to help?" Mr. Vasiliades persisted. "One side of the box says, up. It wouldn't be funny if they broke it." The first engineer agreed, but the box was already in position to be hoisted to the deck. Ropes had been wrapped about it, and the big wharf crane swung around and lowered to allow the hook at the end of its cable to be inserted into a loop of the ropes. Yet nothing happened. Everybody, including the operator of the crane and his high cab, looked at everybody else. What was the trouble? Didn't the crane operator understand that time was precious? "We call that in our country a Chinese puzzle," exclaimed Mr. Vasiliades, as if his country were indeed original. "Someone wants to prove he's an ass. We have the inspector of customs himself here." Mr. Vasiliades gestured toward a gentleman in uniform standing by, "and still the armature is not allowed to come aboard." Peering down at the man on the dock, he continued, "I don't know what that man is saying, but anyway, he has stopped everything." He mopped his brow and pulled his silk shirt away from his armpits. At last, the man on the dock came aboard, and the customs inspector went down to meet him on the main deck. Pink and white papers appeared as if by magic and were waved between them. Then presto, the box was swung onto the ship. "Finished," shouted the dark little man in the cab of the crane, grinning. No doubt it was his one English word, "finished," we shouted back to show our appreciation. The chief engineer, the second engineer, the first electrician, two members of the crew, and Mr. Big gathered around the box as if it were a Christmas present, pried open the top boards, and looked inside. Yes, it was without doubt the armature, for the two crew members very carefully nailed the top boards back down, lifted the box to their shoulders, and disappeared with it into the bowels of the ship. Now we were really ready to sail, but there was a British ship, the Vasco, lying across, or is athwart the nautical term. I certainly don't want to say anything unnautical. Our stern. It was a beautiful ship with a wide, curving sweep of hull painted dark green, its booms and mast white, and its smokestack a holly berry red edged with black. It was loading chrome. To get away from the pier without smashing it took careful maneuvering. Our gangplank up and our stern lines off, the stern slowly swung away from the pier. I watched the blue-green water widen inch by inch like silk being pulled carefully across an ironing board for pressing. Our bow was still held fast to the dock, and as the stern crept out, the bow nudged closer and closer to the piling. Watermelon-shaped bags of padding were lowered to ease the pressure. And still we marked time. The stern seemed scarcely to move at all, but we could all see the silk of the sea widening. When it seemed the bow would surely crush the pier, the captain yelled for the aft and spring lines to be lifted. Men scurried along the dock, heaving the great ropes from the bitts into the water. "All clear aft," the captain called. "All clear," the second mate answered. The engines began to rumble. Our stern was beyond the Vasco, and we could now turn around and head out of the Gulf of Iskenderun for the Mediterranean and Gibraltar. End of chapter 34.